Welcome to the This Is Money podcast, brought to you in partnership with Charles Stanley Direct, the award-winning investment platform trusted by over 40,000 clients. Investment involves risk. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, we became a nation of accidental lockdown savers, putting away record amounts. But will it last? The early signs aren't promising. Meanwhile, the cuts continue after NS&I took the axe to their rates last week. More than a dozen top accounts go in just 5 days. It's the elderly savers, though, who have to rely on call centres that This Is Money's Adrian Lowry is most concerned about. Also, Nationwide launches another savings lottery, but is the latest offering any good? The Bank of England's chief economist says the sky's not going to fall in. Good to know, but what's he talking about? Mortgage approved, then made redundant, but confident of getting a new role? Do you have to tell the bank and forget spending over a grand on a phone? Budget mobiles are back. So what are the best ones out there? Don't be getting up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, so we had more evidence this week that we saved a fair bit during lockdown. The ONS says the percentage of disposable income which households stashed away between April and June this year rose to an all-time high of 29.1%. To give some context, the highest this century was 12.2% that was saved in the first 3 months of 2010 in the aftermath, of course, of the 2008 financial crisis. So over this same lockdown period, we spent less, by an average of 23.6%, and we paid off more debt. Good news, you would think. But firstly, not spending is not the same as saving. Will it last? Early indications are saying no. Spending on credit cards up. Saving rates aren't exactly enticing at the moment. Also, this surely is just a situation for some of the country. What about the rest? And what will hoarding money do for the economic recovery? So many questions. Lee, a very warm welcome. Let's start, though, with some of the actual figures here. What are they telling us? What's the bigger picture?
Well, Georgie, this is a quarterly report that the ONS puts out, and it has done for quite a long time now. And we always keep an eye on it to see kind of, it reflects a little bit of the mood sometimes of the country, as in if people are stashing away money, it's usually for a certain reason. To be honest, in the last sort of couple of decades of this series, the amount of disposable income that is saved usually hovers around about the 10% mark. Since 2016 until this recent set of figures, it's been more around the 5% mark, suggesting that actually people weren't really saving much of their disposable income, which, you know, is one of those kind of scenarios in which, you know, financial journalists and whatnot get a little bit worried about why aren't people tucking money away? Why aren't people saving enough? And then we look at this chart from the latest set of figures from the ONS, which is, as you say, from April to June, and it shot up to almost, you know, £3 in every £10 of disposable income being saved. Now, you're right, it's not, there has been this term banded around of accidental savers, which kind of is right, but not spending isn't really the same as saving. Well, you could argue that it is. People basically were unable to spend as they usually would, going out, having fun,
commuting.
And then we've had things like holiday refunds come in, and then what do you do with that money? You're not going to go in and spend it on another holiday because it was kind of difficult. You might have spent it on a big item, maybe, but it appears that a lot of people have just tucked it away almost for a rainy day. And also the other thing we have to consider, you said there about in the aftermath of the financial crisis, the rate was the highest in 1993, in the start of 1993, when it was 14.4%. And after that, we just had Black Wednesday and all those kind of factors involved where people were a little bit panicky. And that's what I think a lot of this series shows. It shows sometimes a bit of panic as well if there's unemployment on the cards. So like just after the financial crisis, more people are kind of putting money away because they're a little bit more frightened to spend too much on things that they may see as frivolous or non-essential. So this money gets tucked away. And for all of those factors that I just mentioned, this is why the figure's gone up so high. We'll have the next set of figures for between July and September coming in a few months' time. And what I would suspect is that it will drop considerably, but probably still you know, around about the 20% mark, you would expect, because people have been able to spend, you know, thinking about the Eat Out to Help Out scheme, you know, a lot of people took advantage of that. A lot of people saw the summer as, or it might be like a one chance really this year to do a bit of spending. Lots of people actually had holidays in the UK that they might have used that buffer of money that they put away to spend it on. So all of these factors are in play. You're again right in saying that savings rates have, you know, near on collapsed, especially after the NS&I cuts last week. A lot of the money seems to have gone to NS&I, Georgie, to be quite frank with you. I mean, billions and billions of pounds have poured into NS&I.
Yeah.
And now maybe billions and billions of pounds are going to flow out of NS&I because people are thinking, well, I don't want my money in there. But what they do with it next is the big question.
We'll get onto that in a second. What do you do with all that money that you've potentially saved? I'm curious, though, with all that Lee said there, Simon, is this likely to last? Could this create a sort of savings mentality that whenever we talk about the Germans, we always say how what a great savings mentality they have? Or actually, as the figures are starting to show, we're putting more money on credit card now. That could be because people are losing their jobs. It could also be the fact that we feel like we've been stuck inside and we just want to go out and spend. So what do you reckon?
Well, we talk about the savings habit, don't we? People getting into the savings habit. And as with many things, if you do something, saving is habit forming. If you do start saving, you will discover that actually you sort of get into the feel of it and you look at the money building up. You won't look at the interest racking up at the moment, but you will look at the money building up in the pot and you'll start to think, oh, that looks pretty good. That feels pretty good. And that is generally how a lot of people end up, you know, getting into saving, and then they might be a gateway drug and then they get into investing and so on. The big question is, of course, is that whether this is, as Lee said, saving or not spending. And actually, when you read this story and you look at the things that people have been able to save / not spend on, it's astonishing, really, isn't it? Can you imagine if someone had sat you down on New Year's Eve and said, I want to have a chat. I want to have a chat about what we're going to be able to spend on in 2020, and you said, all right, hang on, let me just get a drink first because we're meant to be having fun here. And they said, look, basically between April and June, you're not going to be able to go on holiday. You're not going to be able to go to most of the shops. You're not going to be able to go down the pub. You're not going to be able to go out for dinner. You're not going to be able to probably go to work. You'll probably be told to stay at home. And so you're going to have all this money. What are you going to do with it? And people will go, ah, well, if I had all that money spare, I'd do this. And then you say, yeah, but that's on the list of things you can't do as well. Ah, no, that's on the list of things you can't do as well. Ah, no, can't do that one either. So what do you do with it? Well, you just end up building up the money, don't you? And that is literally what has happened. That is why this savings percentage of disposable income, and bear in mind, this is disposable income, it's after all your bills, has rocketed to almost 30%. And to be salting away 30% of your disposable income is a sort of, you know, a personal finance guru's wonderful and wildest dream that people would start doing this with 30% of their income. The problem is once you start being able to spend again, are people just going to start spending this money? And the risk is, are they going to get used to spending the money that they say that they've not been spending on other stuff, i.e., if they're still working from home and they're saving £300 or £400 a month on the train into work and the commute into work, are they going to get into the habit of spending that £300 or £400? And then all of a sudden it turns out that the new normal isn't that new normal at all. And their work says, we'd like you to come back in, and they're having to spend £300 or £400 on commuting. And they've suddenly got used to spending that £300 or £400 on other stuff. So I would say to anyone who is saving £300 or £400 on commuting at the moment, do keep sticking that in a bank account. Do keep saving that money. And that's where we encounter this wonderful thing called the paradox of thrift, which is that in a recession, you need people to keep spending in order to boost the economy. And arguably, you actually want them to do more spending than they would usually do if they can possibly do it. Yet what people do is they look with fear in their eyes at what they're worried about coming down the line, and they start saving as much money as they possibly can. So arguably the best thing you could do for the economy right now is to spend the money that you're saving on your commute. But arguably the best thing that you could do for yourself right now is not to spend that money, because just like saving can be habit forming, spending can be habit forming as well. But I tell you what, I reckon the place where most people have saved the most money this year is holidays. Now, if they did manage to go on holiday in the UK, they probably won't have saved as much money, because holidays in the UK are notoriously expensive. You save on the flights, but you spend quite a lot of money on, you know, accommodation and things like that. But they might have only gone for a week rather than 2 weeks. And if they haven't been on holiday at all, they, you know, if you're looking at a family, could have saved potentially thousands of pounds. Some of that money, as we know, has gone into big ticket purchases, hot tubs and such like, you know. But as these figures show, a lot of this money is just being lobbed into bank accounts and being sorted away. And, you know, I wouldn't expect people to keep saving 30% of their disposable income, but maybe if once things start to get back to normal, hopefully at some point in the near future, they're saving 15% rather than 5%, well, that would be a positive, wouldn't it?
Lee, we talk about people saving money, paying down debts and the like, but there must be a lot of people listening, a huge amount of people out there, who have not been able to do that, who've had to carry on working perhaps during lockdown, or have had other bills, or who've been made redundant and are not able to do those things. Do you think this situation risks widening the gap of those haves and have-nots?
Quite possibly, Georgie. Yeah, I mean, the situation for everyone across the country is completely different. While we've got people on one hand that, you know, still have jobs and are saving on commuting costs, perhaps they're not back in the office and have been able to bank that money over the months, we've got, you know, unemployment crisis looming, you know, people losing their jobs or, you know, coming to end of furlough, all those kind of things, which, you know, of course, is a worry for people that haven't been able to tuck that money away. So, you know, you're right in pointing that out. And we're seeing an uptick in the latest Bank of England money and credit report suggesting that more money is being spent on credit cards again, back on, you know, personal loans and those kind of things, after billions of pounds have been paid off, which, again, is another good sign over the last few months of people actually were saving some of this money and actually paying off debt as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, of course, not everyone is going to be in this scenario. Some people will kind of be in between the scenarios, as in thinking ahead and thinking, what if my job is at risk? You know, I feel like I think that the majority of the country has had a thought go through their mind at some point that, you know, their job security has never been so fragile. It's definitely not been the most fragile it's been over the last decade. So if they were able to save money, tucking it away just in case something happens, I reckon there's been quite a lot of that, Georgie. I think a lot of people would be like, I don't know how safe my job is, so while I can save this money and not go out and there's no temptation to spend elsewhere, tuck it away if the worst does happen. So I do think there has been a bit of that. But, you know, not everyone has been fortunate enough to be able to build that little pot.
Simon, your views on this? Also, I want to throw in the fact that I made a comparison there with the record savings amounts as a result of, or a consequence perhaps, of the last financial crisis. Is there anything that we can learn from that? I say the last, a period of time when there was an economic instability, should we put it that way? We saved more. What was the lesson that was learned there?
Well, that period of economic instability is basically the paradox of thrift in action. Mm. People worried. People saved more. They saved everything they possibly could. They probably went out a bit less and things like that.
How long did it last, though?
Not very long.
Right.
Actually, no, what was interesting, if you think back to the financial crisis, okay, the financial world was falling apart. Banks were on the precipice of going bust. Some of the biggest banks in the country, we would go into work that morning. It's like, could it be the day that Barclays goes? Could it be the day that Lloyds goes? That's astonishing. That's almost as astonishing as thinking now that like, you know, the whole country might be ordered to stay at home, or there'd be a law against you meeting up with more than five other people. If you told people that last year, they'd just go, you're completely mad. Likewise, if you'd have told people a year before, do you know what? In the news in a year's time, people are going to be talking about whether Barclays are going to go bust. And that kind of worry does encourage people to put money aside. And last time round, it showed how much more money they could put aside without their costs dropping substantially This time around, we've seen how much more money could be put aside with people's costs dropping substantially. But it is a very personal thing, as you were saying, and as Lee said, and there will be people listening to this thinking, I don't recognise that scenario of my spending having dropped substantially. They might recognise a scenario where they couldn't, you know, go to the pub, go to out for dinner, go to the shops for a couple of months. Maybe they save some money on some holidays. But if you don't do that much shopping, like other than your food, if you're not a big shopper, right, you're not a big spender on clothes and, you know, all that kind of stuff, you're probably not going to make notice that much difference. If you, certainly if you don't do many holidays, you probably won't notice that much difference. But even me personally, I read some of this stuff and I'm like, I don't recognize that scenario, because before lockdown, my commuting costs were minimal. I cycle to work every day across London. I maybe got the tube once a week. I spent nothing on commuting. So I was already saving hundreds of pounds a month compared to many of my colleagues, right? Compared to Lee, basically, who gets the train into London every day. Now, we moved just before lockdown, and I did have to start spending on the train, but I'm literally talking about 2 weeks of spending on train journeys. So that's not enough for me to have, I hadn't even really got used to that extra drain on my monthly spending. So I didn't find myself saving those kind of hundreds of pounds. I'm not a big shopper, as in the people I was just talking about. Definitely quite a bit of my disposable income goes on things like going out to dinner and going out for drinks. Well, I've got two children under the age of 10. So other than going out for dinner with the kids, there isn't that much of an opportunity to be spending that much money on going out. Holidays was the one where I didn't spend a lot of money, but my holiday money doesn't tend to come out of like my monthly earnings. It comes out of, I'll build up some money in savings and then I'll spend it on holidays. So I didn't notice that one as much. And then if you look at it from like a household perspective, my wife's self-employed, and because of the work she does, her income's down like 80%, 90% this year. So actually, when I read these stories about the amount of money that people are managing to save, people say, I've never been able to save this much money. That's not a scenario that I personally recognize, but I do know other people who are telling me that, you know, family members and friends who said, yeah, basically, I just suddenly found I was saving so much money. Yeah. So it is a very, very personal scenario. And whether you look at it this time or post-financial crisis or, you know, in the 1990s recession or whatever, it will still all be very dependent on a personal scenario. And yeah. I guess the one thing that we didn't have this time that hit financial crisis, 1990s as well, was people's mortgage costs going up substantially. So financial crisis, basically, the way people felt that was all of a sudden, you know, the world of the two-year fixed rate mortgage, your broker always told you, don't worry, at the end you'll be able to remortgage, at the end you'll be able to remortgage. And then you suddenly had all these people who either A, couldn't remortgage because people wouldn't lend to them at low loan to value, or B, could remortgage, but rates had gone up. So they were either slipping onto SVRs, which were much more expensive standard variable rates than their two-year fix, or they were having to remortgage onto higher rates rather than lower rates. And all of a sudden, that was a big squeeze on their monthly income. Go back to the 1990s, you didn't really have fixed rate mortgages back then. Most people had variable rate mortgages. And as our parents' generation will tell us, they were paying super, super high interest rates on their mortgages and they were really feeling the squeeze on it. Now you don't really have that effect as much, but there is a worry actually that with what's going on with this mortgage crunch on small deposit mortgages, you know, the complete evaporation of 10% deposit mortgages. And whilst there might be a property market mini boom at the moment, concerns the house prices will actually fall over the next year or so, that you're going to see people start to get squeezed on their mortgages. And if they suddenly jump from a fixed rate of 2.5% to a standard variable rate of 4.5%, that's going to be pretty expensive and they're going to hit them in the pocket.
Lee, I want to go back to the idea of savings, because you mentioned earlier about the kind of paucity of accounts and where you can put your money. We had, of course, those brutal NS&I cuts, landscape looking even more bleak as a result of that, because in the last 5 days, we've had a dozen top accounts disappearing. However, into the breach, maybe steps nationwide with a premium bond lottery style drawing saving offering thing, but is it any good? So firstly, the NS&I wielding the axe, what's been the consequence or the knock-on effect?
That's right. So we spoke about this last week, and the cuts were just so brutal. As Adrian Lowry described in his column this week, it was like they put their foot on the accelerator to get all the money in and then suddenly slammed on the brakes, and savers have got whiplash as a result, which I thought was a great analogy of what NS&I have done. And it's cut. So, yeah, unfortunately, because NS&I were propping up the market quite a lot in terms of having a couple of Best Buy accounts, naturally, where there's people putting money into other options, smaller challenger banks, building societies, they fill their coffers quite quickly, and those offers get pulled, and then it's just a rinse and repeat, and rates continue to fall. One of the most brutal ones was actually when we were speaking on the podcast last week. I got a tip off that Marcus Bank, remember they launched with a 1.5% easy access account in September 2018, so 2 years ago. They were making its biggest cut yet, and its rate is going to fall to 0.7%. Now, the reason why that's quite a big deal is that it actually had to stop offering easy access savings accounts because it had pulled in so much money where it was the Best Buy for so long that it was going to breach regulatory limits. Mm-hmm. So there's more than £20 billion in that account. And there's some astonishing stats that I've seen this week as well, suggesting that £4 in every 10 that is saved currently earns less than 0.1%. That is in all savings accounts. So just imagine if people actually started to move that money away from, 0.1%, even if it goes to 0.7% and Mark is changing this account, it's still better than what the majority of people are doing with their savings. So we've had a raft of challengers and building societies wield the axe. There's going to be more of this, Georgie, as time goes on. The big thing that will make that happen is whether people can be bothered to move their money out of NS&I. It's a two-factor thing, NS&I. You've got premium bonds where a lot of money is held, and you've got just your savings accounts are the products that have had the deepest cuts. And it's whether people can be bothered to move the money out and whether they do it. And again, as Adrian reported this week, and we've seen reports of people are struggling to get their money out of NS&I and putting money in. The call centre, we've had reports of...
Yeah, he says it's the elderly he feels sorry for most who have to rely on the call centres.
Well, exactly, yeah, because, if you're reliant on the... Well, not reliant, but if you're kind of internet savvy, you can kind of do this stuff online quite quickly. But if you're not so internet savvy, it's more of a rigmarole to phone up NS&I, close your account, move the money somewhere else. And a lot of people just go, it's not worth all the hassle. So, all of these factors are at play. The cuts from NS&I come in actually in November, and whether or not there's a mass exodus of money remains to be seen. But if there is, and that starts going elsewhere, those accounts get pulled and it's just a vicious cycle, and rates will just continue to fall. Now, Nationwide, mm-hmm. I've launched this new account with a kind of lottery style element to it. Now, I've got mixed feelings on this, Georgie. First of all, I think that savings and a lottery style draw are kind of alarm bells for me. It's kind of different goals, it's different things. But on the flip side of that, at least Nationwide are doing something. At least they're having a go. At least we're getting a rate of 0.5%, an underlying rate. Okay, 0.5%, you go, cool, that's awful. Well, it is awful. But I tell you what, you compare that to the other big banks. I mean, at least it's something. And there's a chance to win £10,000 with this new mutual reward bond. So it works. For every £100 you save up to £10,000, you get a ticket in this one draw that's happening next February. And the amount of prizes, the amount of 10,000 prizes that are on offer depends on how much people save into the account. So it will just see the overall amount that's been saved into it, and then it will do a draw, and then you could win £10,000. And obviously, the more money you have in it, the more tickets you have, and the more chance you have of winning. And they say there's a 200 to 1 chance of winning £10,000. So if you attempt to buy this account, don't think you're going to win that £10,000, but the odds on offer are pretty good. They're not a long shot of Grand National good, but they're still pretty good when you compare it to NS&I and other similar accounts that are out there. And it's not the first time Nationwide have done this, actually. They kind of did it with, they were targeting people with this £100 a month account, which has a 3 monthly draw. So it has a draw every 3 months to win £100. So they kind of had a bit of form in this. And George Nixon, our savings reporter, had a look at how other odds compare. And he looked at premium bonds. Someone that had £10,000 in premium bonds has a 133,000 to one shot of doubling their money. So the nationwide odds are considerably distant better than that. And Family Building Society has a similar thing called a windfall bond. If you've got 10 grand in that, you've got one in 7,500 chance of winning 10 grand. So the nationwide offer on paper looks right. It's just whether or not you see it as a form of gambling or not. And I don't know if I do.
Counts the future, Lee, though?
I don't know. It could be. Because I think a lot of Britons have that kind of underlying desire to win big on the lottery, even if people say, oh, the lottery is an idiot tax, you know, and all that kind of stuff. At least with this, you're going to get your stake back. You know, so with a lottery, you spend £2 on a ticket, you don't win, you've lost your £2. You save £100, £10,000 in this nationwide account. Well, you're going to get your money back, plus a bit of interest, plus the chance of winning £10,000. I think it's kind of clever from Nationwide, because they kind of know that people are starved of rates. They might be now looking elsewhere because the premium rate, you know, the premium rate, premium bond is still quite a different product. It will have an underlying rate of 1% come November. So that's better than what's on offer from Nationwide. And also it has a draw every month. You know, this Nationwide one is just a one-off draw over 18 months. So it's an 18-month fixed bond. You can't touch your money until after 18 months. And there's just one draw. Whereas in that whole time, you would have had 18 draws, the premium bonds. And premium bonds have two top prizes of £1 million. So kind of different, but kind of similar. And I think Nationwide know what they're doing with this. And I think I think it will be popular. Nationwide has a big customer base, starved of interest elsewhere. They might have other products of Nationwide in which the rate has completely crashed. And they go, do you know what? I'm going to move that from there into this reward account and hope for the best.
In sum, for all we've been saying, things aren't looking great out there. I think economically speaking, that's a fair comment. But the sky is not about to fall in. That is the message from the Bank of England's chief economist, Andy Haldane, who is urging us not to go all chicken licking on him. Simon, what on earth is he on about?
Don't be scared. Don't be a fraidy cat. Don't be chicken licking, says Andy Haldane, leading people to go, what? So basically he's saying that actually there's quite a lot of economic good news out there. So the economic bad news everybody knows about. That's obvious. We've pressed the big pause button. On the economy. We just talked about all the things very shortly ago on this podcast that you couldn't do for 3 months. And there's still quite a lot of stuff you can't really do now. Holiday roulette continues. But actually, the bounce back has been powerful. You know, it's been very, very strong and has actually probably surprised a lot of people. It's looked more V-shaped than most people expected it to look. There was lots of talk of this, you know, what shape would the recovery be? U, V, W, X, Y, Z. And it has really, really gone down very substantially and then rocketed back up. And he said, you know, we should talk this one up instead of talking this one down. We should take some confidence from it. Instead of catastrophizing the current scenario, i.e. looking for the worst and all the bad things that's happened, and going, it's going to get worse, it's going to get worse, it's going to get worse. Let's look at the positive stuff that's happened and let's look at the rebound in consumer spending. Let's look at people's desire to get out there and get things back up and running. Let's look, instead of worrying about the number of people who haven't gone back to the office, let's look at the number of people who have. Let's look at how well places are doing even without that. Now, it's hard to do that when you're seeing waves and waves of job losses, but adapt to survive and all that kind of stuff. We had a really great interview with the boss of Pret the other week, done by one of our colleagues on the Mail on Sunday. And he said, look, we need to not worry about the fact that people aren't, we don't need to worry about when people are going back to the office. We need to think about how we're going to go to the people who aren't, kind of thing. It's like, we need to do something about this. We can't just sit here and go, oh, please come back, please come back, please come back. So that's the kind of stuff that Andy Haldane is hinting at. Now, obviously, I guess if you've lost your job and you are staring down the barrel of severe financial hardship And you are living in a local lockdown area and you've been told that you can't do lots of things and you're worried we're going to go into national lockdown and you're deeply concerned that Matt Hancock is going to personally cancel Christmas and stand at your front door turning your relatives away and saying, I'm sorry guys, you can't come in, there's more than five people in there already, and I'm the sixth Matt Hancock for Christmas, then you're going to be thinking, what on earth is Andy Haldane talking about? Things look pretty bad. But he does have a point, economically speaking. So I guess it's, is your glass half full or is your glass half empty? And Andy Haldane's is half full, but he has to finish it by 10 o'clock, like everyone else.
Simon, I don't think anyone's glass is half full after listening to that stuff of nightmares there.
Oh, come on, it's not all bad. I mean, obviously Matt Hancock come for Christmas would be awful.
Yeah, no, that's what I was talking about. That is the stuff of nightmares.
Yeah, right. Okay, so the rest of it is fine, but Matt Hancock might come for Christmas.
I was feeling bad about ruining Christmas, and then I thought you presented a scenario that could be worse. So actually, I feel a bit more positive about that situation. Yeah,
imagine, I mean, to be honest, though, I feel really sorry for my friend, okay, who's got four kids, one wife. So that's a family of six. And that means, okay, Father Christmas can't come. Because if Father Christmas comes into the house, there will be seven people there.
Well, that's, you just got to lob it through the chimney. So maybe they should put some pillows at the bottom just to protect the presents. No, leave them out the front door like an Amazon delivery driver. I'm trying to help.
Okay, my favorite thing of the pandemic, a delivery driver sort of constantly evolving scenario, is the ring the doorbell and then run away scenario that we've got at the moment. Has anybody noticed this with their Amazon drivers? And I do understand this because obviously they need to stay away from you and everything. But it's like a game of parcel knockdown ginger.
Parcel knockdown ginger? What's that?
Yeah. They ring the doorbell and then I find that our delivery drivers around here, they ring the doorbell and then they wait for you to nearly get to the door. When they just see you get to the door, they then run off.
Yeah, that's true. That happens. But it's better than in the past where they'd just go, we came to your door and we rang the bell, but you weren't in. And no, I was there. I was in all day. They don't do that anymore because I can't get away with it. Right. I did say that I would talk about mortgages. And this is a lockdown related, coronavirus related potential issue, I imagine, or it's going to be an issue for a lot of people. Look, the reality is the sky may not be falling in, but people will sadly lose their jobs. Now, we have a reader question, basically about the fact you've just had a mortgage approved. They sadly lost their job. He's been told that, or she's been told that the company is making them redundant because coronavirus is hurting their finances. They're pretty confident they'll get another job and quite quickly. So it shouldn't affect their repayments. Do they have to tell the mortgage lender? If I don't tell them, will they find out anyway?
What do you think the answer is?
I think you probably should let them know. Could be wrong.
Yeah, that is
all right. End of subject. Lee,
it's one of those questions, isn't it? It's like you ask the question, you know the answer. It's like, yeah, I know.
But will they find it out anyway?
Possibly not.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not advocating not telling them. You have to tell them. You could potentially be committing mortgage fraud if you don't tell them. If your mortgage lender finds that you've deliberately withheld something. Or not told them. And there will be something somewhere in the paperwork that says if your circumstances change whilst the application is ongoing, that you do have to tell them. Mm-hmm. So if you don't tell them, like the greatest sort of risk scenario is that they could just call in your mortgage. They could just say you have to pay it back now, which is obviously a massive issue for people because they don't tend to have mortgage-sized sums of money sitting around ready to pay back at the shortest notice. Now, it's highly unlikely that they would do that. But if they did, you could face losing your home, repossession, very, very bad mark on your credit file and all that kind of stuff. They probably wouldn't find out. It's, the old question of, do I have to tell my mortgage lender I'm renting out my house? Yes, you do have to tell your mortgage lender. You have to get permission from them to rent out your house, and they might try and charge you for permission to let. They might try and make you go on to buy to let mortgage or things like that. But lots of people do get away with it. But just because people do get away with stuff doesn't mean that you should do it, and doesn't mean that there isn't a risk from when you get caught out. And I feel very sorry for anybody in this position, because it's quite likely that they might find at the moment that their mortgage lender pulls the application.
Okay, Lee, mobile phones. Let's go there, shall we? Because the Apple iPhone, the latest iteration, number 753, is about to launch. I mean, in 2017, when the last one came out, I still don't know if it's an X or a 10. I'm not in the Apple ecosystem. It was over $1,000. That's 3 years ago. So goodness knows how much this is going to be. I don't know how much it's going to be. But I just want to know, Lee, have we lost the appetite for spending ridiculous amounts of money on something that, let's be honest, is probably way too powerful for what we need it for, and we're going to end up smashing the screen anyway? The economy is in a bit of a tight spot. We've discussed that. People worried about their personal finances. But also, what is the point? Like, every 2 years, we're on this kind of, like, buy a new mobile merry-go-round. But are they materially different, the offering? Or maybe they've got wireless earphones this time. Annoying, can I just say? Or some rounded screen, don't care. I mean, unless something has a battery life that's going to last me until next week, I'm not interested, Lee. I bought my phone and I'm happy with my SIM only. The reason we're mentioning this is because Nokia's back. It's brought out a smartphone for under 100 quid. And you've been looking at the top budget smartphones, haven't you?
Georgie, I think you've just tapped into a lot of people's thoughts on the new mobile phone
industry. Woman of the people, Lee. Woman of the people.
I think you are. And I think you echoed quite a lot of how I feel about these phones. I saw a great graph recently in the last couple of months in which it was like a real U-shape of mobile phone prices. So back in the day when you used to have if you wanted a mobile phone, it would have been in your car. And it was one of those massive, big, old, chunky things that you see in those sort of 1980s stockbroker movies where they're walking around carrying basically a brick on a brick, chatting. And they were very expensive back then because obviously the technology was just out. There was a lot of, basically, technology has improved vastly and become cheaper. And we had this big U shape where we got into sort of like the 2000s where mobile phones were actually quite inexpensive. But now our mobile phones do so much more than they did a decade ago, where, you know, we go on the internet, we have all these apps, all these things we do on it, we watch the television on it, we do all sorts of things on phones that probably even a decade ago we never thought we would do. But what has happened is that the graph has gone straight back up again, and it's closing in on how much it costs back in the day to have one of those big old brick phones. And it's just packed full of technology. And you're totally right. I mean, people smash their screens so frequently, and on £1,000 phone, if you've got to go and replace the screen and it costs 150 quid a pop, you know, these things break so easily, even with good phone cases and all those kind of things. And I think people are fed up of it. And the other thing I would say, and this is something I would definitely say has happened to me, is I get a phone, I get a new phone, I never get the latest model, I always get maybe the one before because I just can't justify the cost of paying, even if it's a monthly cost. Is that I have the phone for a couple of years and I'm like, well, this is a good phone. And then you get the salespeople phoning up, your contract's up. Do you want a new phone? Here's a new phone. Why don't you have this new phone? And it's like, whoa, hold on a second. This is real consumerism 101, isn't it? It's like, my phone is still perfectly good. I've looked after it. It does everything I need it to do. I don't need a one with an extra camera, a couple of megapixels better, or it's got a slightly faster processor, or maybe it can use 5G. I mean, look, at the end of the day, we've got to a point now where our phones have reached such a good standard that we're kind of happy with what we've got. I think the large majority of the population are happy with what we've got. We always have people, Apple fans, that will want the latest phone. But there's all sorts of sneaky things, I think, that's happening from mobile phone operators and things as well. So whereas a two-year contract was kind of a norm, we're seeing three-year contracts sort of creep in, and that can mean the actual overall cost is more than it would have been. Buying the phone actually up front and having a SIM-only deal can be considerably cheaper, but people sometimes just don't factor in that or just think, oh, I don't want any upfront cost. And basically, George, there's a lot of people out there that simply just want to use the phone back what a Nokia 3310 used to do, you know, text and make phone calls. There are a lot of people that just want to use it for that. And why do they need the internet? Why do they need a smartphone? Luckily, though, there's been a bit of a fight back in the last year, and there's a number of budget models that have come into play that have forced the hand of Apple and Samsung. I think they've turned around and thought, actually we do need to have a kind of budget option for people. And when I say budget, I'm still talking about £300-400 from the likes of Samsung and Apple, but that is cheap when you're comparing it to a £1,200 latest model from them. And these phones can still surf the internet. They can still take great quality photographs. I remember getting my first ever camera phone, Georgie, and the pictures on it were like a grainy, pixelated, weird thing. And I remember thinking, wow, I've taken a photograph with my mobile phone. Now people want all of these features and zoom in and all this absolute rubbish stuff that it means we take great photos. When's the last time you printed out a load of photos from your phone? When's the last time you made a good photo?
Last week.
Well, okay. Well, last you week. Can.
Only for the fact I've been away. So I was like,
but a lot of people don't. They're just trapped inside a screen for all eternity. Yeah. And then like the phone dies or breaks. And then there's that mad panic of, can I get all the photos off my phone before it all goes? Outside of Samsung and Apple and Google for that matter, because Google also has its Pixel phones now, Nokia, I've kind of, they were the number one mobile phone maker until kind of Apple muscled in and Samsung muscled in, and Nokia were the kind of, you know, the brand you went for from the kind of late 90s to the mid 2000s. And it looked like there was no stopping that big Finnish giant. There was no way there was anyone that was going to usurp it, but it did. And it's had a tough time since. But it's kind of carving out a bit of a niche for itself now in a kind of budget smartphone way. So you can get budget phones for next to nothing, but they won't surf the internet. Or if they do, they won't surf the internet very well. Nokia is kind of making these sort of like cheaper version phones. So it's got a OnePlus that costs £70, which will surf the internet. Now, the jury is out how good quality that is. I had a look at Amazon reviews, they weren't
big
good.
Big fan. And anyone that I've spoken to who knows about tech, including my Uber driver, is a big fan of OnePlus, by the way.
Well, you think about it, though,
every Georgie, Uber driver, I just had one that was big fan of it.
70 quid. If it's got a good battery life and you can surf the internet, you kind of know what you're going to get for 70 quid, don't you? Now, it's cheaper. I think that's half the price of fixing smashed screen on a phone. And that's why people will like this kind of thing, especially if you've got a job like that where you're likely to drop it, or you Uber drivers, for instance, just have them plugged in all the time. And it's like a glorified sat nav, isn't it, for a lot of drivers like that. And there's other roles and things where, you know, if you've got children, God, I mean, the amount of times my daughter picks up my phone and she drops it on the phone on the floor and I think, oh, that's going to smash. You know, there's a whole raft of people out there that will look at these cheap budget smartphones and go, yeah, it's a good idea. So it has a new one coming out, the Nokia 3.4, which is going to cost £129, and a Nokia 2.4, which will cost £99. And these two are going to probably be a bit of a leap up from its OnePlus. It's almost like the next version on from this. But at those sort of prices, Georgie, you can see why people are interested. And I think my gut instinct is in the next few years, mobile phone prices are going to start coming down again. You know, technology is obviously always improving, and shrinking these things down into phones become more and more inexpensive. And then you'd like to think consumers get fed up with paying more than a grand. On the flip side of that, though, what we'll come into the defense of an expensive phone is that we carry them with us all the time, and we use them, you know, quite a lot of the time. And as I say, they do all sorts of different things now. I think I use my phone more to watch Netflix and Amazon Prime than I do make phone calls or send messages to people. It's become like a little television in my pocket. And again, would never, ever, ever have thought that that would be a possibility. So it depends. In my mind, you get what you pay for.
Agreed. I understand that. And if there was a massive difference, and I don't know, because I think what we do is, I talked about the Apple ecosystem, but we tend to get caught in whatever ecosystem we've become used to. Simon, you do have a story, because we were discussing this on Twitter, because that's the exciting conversations that we have on Twitter. And you have a story about your mobile phone history.
Yeah, I have owned two brand new mobile phones in my life.
Amazing. I can't believe that.
The first only two. Was when I was 19. I got my first mobile phone. It was a Nokia. It was a sizable little fella. It was also yellow. I didn't want a yellow one. Yellow was, I believe, the only choice. Actually, no, maybe that one wasn't yellow. Maybe that one was blue. Maybe the first hand-me-down I had was yellow. Right, so it's blue anyway. I took out the insurance in the shop. I got it from Phones for You. It was when I started university. I hadn't had a mobile phone before then. Any people starting university this year listening to this podcast will will be bemused at the fact that there existed a world not that long ago where people might not own a mobile phone until university. But genuinely, hardly anybody had them, and B, you didn't need them. I had a mate who started university with a pager, and he wasn't even a drug dealer or a doctor. So I got my first mobile phone, and I had it for a couple of weeks. I was paying, I don't know how much, but probably enough to get yourself into a decent pocket computer, aka smartphone nowadays. But it was for something that the most technologically advanced thing it could do was send text messages, make phone calls, and play Snake. I was also paying maybe an extra £10 a month for insurance. And the insurance had been sold to me as a pretty comprehensive insurance. And then I lost my phone.
How was the insurance then, Simon?
Useless. Yeah. Absolutely useless. Basically, I mean, it was an accident. I think that what I might have done is driven off with it on the roof of the car. So I'd been around to my nana's house, and my nana gave me some plants to take around to my mum. And I remember leaving my nana's house with the plants and my phone. And then I arrived home with just the plants and not the phone. And I couldn't work out where the phone was. I went back to my nana's, searched the house. We looked everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it was an absolute mystery. It then dawned on me that I may possibly, when I opened the car, because in those days also you had to use a key to open a car door. Nowadays you don't. I think I might have put the phone on the roof of the car while I opened the car door and the plants, and then I put the plants in the car but not the phone. Anyway, the insurance had been sold to me as literally covers anything that could possibly go wrong, including being a moron.
It didn't.
They said that it didn't cover me for accidental loss. I was like, but that is literally what the man in the shop who sold me this expensive insurance told me. And they said, no, it doesn't. So I was like, right, okay then, just fine, just cancel the contract. And they said, no, sorry, Mr. Lambert, you signed up to a 12-month contract, you have to continue to pay us £35 a month. And I was like, what are you talking about, you lunatics? I've got a phone. And they were like, yeah, well, you did have the phone and you lost the phone. And I said, okay, all right then. Well, firstly, I don't believe you. Secondly, I want you to send me my contract so I can check. And thirdly, you can cancel the insurance then, at least, which isn't paying out. And they told me that that they would send me my contract, that I had to believe them and I did have to continue paying. But I also had to continue paying for the insurance, which I thought was a bit rich to continue paying for the insurance on a phone that I didn't have when the insurance didn't pay out anyway. This ended up with a long running backwards and forwards scenario with Phones For You, who may have underestimated how stubborn I was. And I just basically kept sending them letters saying, you need to send me my contract. Well, because I gave up on phoning and sent them a letter, you sent me my contract, and they didn't. So I just cancelled the direct debit. And then they started coming after me for the money, and that's where I was stubborn. I was like, well, I'm not paying you. So it ran around in circles. But basically, I pointed out to them that the moment they didn't send me even if they argued that I still had to pay for this phone, actually, they were in breach of contract, because the moment they didn't send me my contract after I'd asked for it a couple of times, they were therefore in breach of contract and they weren't providing me with the service that they were meant to. Eventually, after about a year, they gave up and didn't come after me for the money anymore and said they were going to write it off. But that experience led me to not get a brand new mobile phone for another 22 years of my life.
Well, lesson learned, Simon.
I know. Even if it was unlikely that I was going to drive off with it on the roof of my car. So the long-winded story that we've been through there basically involves me switching to having no mobile phone for a while. Mm-hmm. And then after deciding that probably I did need a mobile phone, just having SIM-only deals and hand-me-down phones. And I've had hand-me-downs from my family, about a couple from my sisters, and I've had them from friends. I've mainly had them for free. I have occasionally paid people some money for them. So, look, I'll give you some money for it, kind of thing. And it's done me perfectly fine. I've lived through all those years absolutely okay. Cheap SIM-only deal. Tenner a month, or for quite a long period of it, less than a tenner a month. And then this year,
yeah,
I bought a new mobile phone. I know some people went crazy in lockdown and bought hot tubs and pizza ovens and outdoor kitchens. I went absolutely nuts. And
why?
As a fully paid up grown up, bought a brand new iPhone SE. Largely,
did you leave
because,
it on the top of the car?
No. It's not yet. This is not going to work for anybody listening to this, but I'm waving it to prove that it still exists. I even went completely nuts and actually bought a case to go on it after being told by my wife for years that I needed to get a case and smashing numerous phone screens because I refused to put a case on a mobile phone. And I bought it because I needed a new phone and I could have just chased down another hand-me-down, but the value that was on offer from the iPhone SE seemed to be pretty good. It's basically 400 quid and it's what they were flogging to people as the iPhone 11 not so long ago for nearly a grand in a slightly different design. And I thought, well, maybe I'll go nuts in lockdown and buy myself a new mobile phone. And I have actually been very impressed with it. Not on a contract, though. I bought the phone outright and it's still on Simone.
So. Fair enough.
And having told you that extremely long-winded story, I guarantee you I will be losing this phone or breaking it within the next 24 hours.
When you were talking, I had images. Do you remember when you were little and you had mittens? I don't know if anyone else had this, but I had a little string all the way through, which went through my sleeves and the jacket so that I never lost them. They just kind of hung there. I've got images of like a little mitten string thing so you can kind of have it always on you, Simon.
You need something on the other end of the string. What am I going to put on the other end of the string?
We can think about that.
Or my door keys.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Whatever else you like.
I did that thing where you leave the door keys in the door overnight the other day.
Oh, no, I've done that.
Yeah, we left the house yesterday. My wife was like, you left the door keys in the door overnight.
Right, so if you've ever had a phone or haven't bought a new phone for longer than 22 years, did you say, Simon?
22 years between brand new phones, yeah.
I would love to hear, can anyone beat Simon's record? If you have any comments or questions to the team, anything you'd like them to look into, apart from mobile phones, or any suggestions so that Simon cannot lose his, that's better than my mitten effort, because I appreciate we do need something on the other side. Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join the debate and read the comments and tell me that you never want to hear another 5-minute story about my life in phones ever again.
5 minutes, Simon. I think it was longer than that, to be fair. But anyway, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking world news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us. The This Is Money podcast is brought to you with Charles Stanley Direct. Open an account today and start saving for your future. Investment involves risk.